Well, whenever webmaster Lex Lonehood takes a day off for his backup weekender, Sean LaJoussure takes a day off or so, who fills in? Well, you're going to meet him. Greg Bishop joins us in a moment. But sure, we're going to talk a little bit about the incredible coasttocoastam.com website and how it's put together and some of the things you can do. But that's not the program tonight. Greg is an expert on the paranormal, and I'll tell you all about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Greg Bishop. Greg has been researching and writing about strange phenomena for more than 25 years. Back in 1991, he co-founded a magazine called The Excluded Middle, which was a journal of UFOs, conspiracy research, psychedelica, and new science. From December of 2007 to 2011, he wrote extensively for the UFO and paranormal site UFO Mystic and has written articles for scores of magazines and websites and, of course, works with us on the coasttocoastam.com website. For a couple of years, Greg also hosted The Hungry Ghost, a radio show of interviews and music airing on a private radio station in Los Angeles, and his current interview show podcast can be accessed at RadioMystericio.com, and I'm going to spell that for you because we have it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. RadioMystericio.com. Greg, how the heck do you pronounce that?
Radio. Actually, if you want to pronounce it like Spanish, it's Radio Misterioso. But yeah, Radio Misterioso, most people call it. So it's spelled like Spanish.
I'm glad we have a link because I don't know how many people would learn how to spell that.
Yeah, right? I know. Usually they put in the Y, M-Y-S-T-E-R-I-O-S-O.
Exactly.
But, you know, it'll show up no matter what you type in.
It's good to have you on the program. I know you were with us back about a year ago with George Knapp, but it's good to have you back.
Yes, thanks so much, George. When I got the call, I was like, wow, I finally get to talk to George Norrie on the air.
You know, I was talking to Lex during one of the commercial breaks a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. and I said, Lex, I want to get Greg on the show. And he said, great idea. Let's do it. And then, bang, here you are. So, great. How do you like working on the coasttocoastam.com website?
I was just talking to somebody about that today. And you know what it does? It does what UFO Mystic used to do for me. It kind of keeps me up to date on what's going on. I get to hear who's doing research, what they're doing, what they're talking about, what the rumors are, all that. So it kind of keeps my head in the game, and I like it for that. And the other thing is I have to engage with it. Instead of just listening to it passively, I have to engage with the material because I have to do those write-ups that people see on the site. When somebody's on the show, I have to sort of summarize what they said, try to make it clear and easy to understand.
You help write the newsletter?
Yeah. I help a little bit on the newsletter. Yeah, sometimes more, sometimes less. But yeah, and I really enjoy it. Like I said, I'm just really interested in the subject matter, so it's kind of a dream job.
Well, you do a great job for us, and you really help Lex and Sean quite a bit, and it's important. And you help me a lot, too, because you send out my tweets whenever I need to do that and things like that. And it's just a constantly busy, busy job,
yeah,
isn't it?
There's breaking news sometimes. I'll send it, too. I think I've done that with you also. One time I was working with George Knapp was when Charles Manson was announced that he had died.
Uh-huh.
And that happened
right
during the show, so I sent a message to him. He was able to announce it right away.
And you work on our Facebook page too, don't you?
Yeah. I watch the Facebook page. I put posts up for it. I'm just one of the people that does it, but yeah, I do that too.
Well, that's great.
People think it's an automated system that puts those things up. It's not.
Oh, no.
People actually doing that.
It is very labor-intensive, to be sure. You folks are like our editors, basically.
Yeah. We have to take all this information, kind of winnow it down so that it's easily understandable and accessible for people if they want to find out more.
Let's get into how you got into this field of the paranormal and the unusual. How did this happen for you?
You know, I get asked that, and the only thing I can think is that when I was a kid, my dad used to take us to the library every week, my sister and I, and he'd say, take out four or five books, and then you'll read them, and we'll come back next week, and we'll just keep doing it. We did that for years throughout my childhood from when I could first read. And I have no idea why, George, but I went immediately to the section. It's the first section, actually, in the library. It's UFOs, paranormal, ghosts, things like that, and I read all the books. In fact, I read almost nothing else. And then we went to another library when I finished with those, and I found all the books that weren't at the first library and read those too. So I don't know why I did it. I really don't. And I don't think I've been abducted or anything like that. It's just very interesting to me because it flatters my prejudices about things not being exactly the way people think they are.
Greg, what would you say you specialize in? What specific topic in the field of the paranormal and unusual?
It's probably most definitely UFOs. Most of the people on my show we're talking about UFO stuff because it's the most fascinating subject to me.
I always argue with Steve Bassett, of course, who's with ExoPolitics, that government is not going to come out and disclose. We're going to get it from whistleblowers or people like Tom DeLonge who, you know, have an organization now up and running. That's how we're going to find out about it. But we're not going to get it from government. There's not going to be a government news conference. And the president's going to come out and say, folks, this has been going on since the beginning of time. It's not going to happen that way.
No, I don't think so either, mainly because, nothing's really changed my opinion, I don't think that the powers that be really know what they're dealing with. And what are you going to do, come out and say, oh, well, there's this thing going on, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know how to control it?
Yeah.
You can't really say that.
And they're abducting you or taking humans, and we can't stop them.
Yeah, or something like that. I mean, it's not something that's going to happen. I think the what I push for, and even after the Tom DeLonge business over the past few months, there's positive and negatives there that we can talk about. But what I push for is you don't need Big Brother to tell you what's going on. There's plenty of research, mind power, researchers, authors, everybody that have been looking at this for a long time that probably have just as much or more, and probably better information than you'd get from the government. In fact, people in the government that are interested in this are probably reading their research and their books all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure they're listening to you right now, by the way, on the program.
Oh, no.
Yes, they are. So what would you say categorically that you believe in right now with UFOs?
I think that there is a phenomenon that has been going on ever since there's been humans. I think that some of it is unexplained. That's the fascinating part that we all want to know about. And more importantly, and that I get this from people, they say, you're a skeptic, a debunker. I was like, no, I'm not. I really do think there's a phenomenon. And more importantly, I think there's some kind of intelligence behind it. I don't know what form that intelligence takes. I don't want to get myself into, you know, back myself into a corner saying it's this thing or that thing, because all you see in the UFO community is people saying, you know, what they think it is. And it's all of these things and none of them at the same time. So I'm interested in just about all aspects of it.
Well, and I've always said, Greg, it's healthy to be a skeptic. Keep an open mind. Look for the truth. Look for the answers. You don't necessarily have to go into it as a believer. But once you get the results and the data and the evidence, then make a good decision.
Yeah, and I don't know if we'll ever get the results or the data, the evidence. We have a whole bunch of that, but I don't know what kind of conclusions we can make out of it. So I leave my mind open to the possibilities. That's basically, I think, what a real skeptic is. You do not make a decision, like you just said, until you have enough information. And more importantly, if you don't have enough information, you don't have to make a decision.
Exactly.
Keep looking into it. Keep researching. Keep finding things out. Keep talking to people.
A couple pilots around Arizona just reported a few days ago some very strange object, which they said was definitely not a plane. I mean, these things are popping up all over the place, aren't they?
Yeah, they've been popping up all over the place for a long time. They seem to go in waves, which I'm sure the listeners and you notice. And also the media interested in it seems to go in waves as well.
Our guest, Greg Bishop, who is a paranormal expert, has his own podcast. We'll tell you about that a little bit later on in the program. How many books do you have out now?
I think four or five, something like that.
What's the most recent one?
Most recent call is called It Defies Language. It's basically a bunch of essays I did on that UFO Mystic site along with Nick Redfern. He was the other writer on the site.
Good guy.
Yeah, Nick and I have been friends for quite a long time. He actually got me involved with the site. He just asked me if I'd be interested, and I jumped at the chance.
And your first book was Wake Up Down There, right?
Yeah, that was a collection of stuff from my magazine, Excluded Middle, that I founded with two friends, Robert Larson and Peter Stenzel, in 1991, way back then. It went for 10 years, and it was kind of like putting myself through another another college degree or something, just doing that magazine, meeting people and talking to them and writing about it.
And based on the research you've done, Greg, what could you conclude about UFOs at this point?
I don't know if I can make any kind of conclusion about them, except, like I said before, there is something strange seen. We're not sure what it is, and some of it seems to be has intelligence behind it, but I'm not sure what the nature of that intelligence is.
Dr. David Jacobs believes that there's something very nefarious, something not good happening with UFOs. What do you think?
I think that's part of the story, but not all of it. And if you get, I think some researchers, they get completely into their research and they forget that there's other people that either don't agree with them or have completely different research that disagrees with what they're putting on it. Like many researchers have a completely positive view of the abduction scenario. So who's right? I'm not sure.
So let's talk about some of the strange things that you've covered or investigated. What would you say is the wildest thing you've come across?
Oh,
that
God.
You can say on the radio.
Come across? Let's see. I'll tell you a very strange story.
All right.
In the mid-1990s, somebody approached me saying he was from the Navy, from Naval Intelligence, and started handing me documents, showing me pictures that he said were taken at Area 51, telling me that people could listen into my phone conversations, that they could read what was on my computer screen from the outside of my building, and things like this started happening. While I was talking to this guy, suddenly I started getting strange phone calls at all hours of the day and night. And this was on my landline, and I did, you know, I had a answering machine on it, but if the answering machine picked it up, it would just be like silence.
Yeah.
And if the answering machine didn't pick it up, it would ring like 30, 40, 50 times.
Weird.
It would just keep ringing until I picked it up, and there would be silence again on the other end, or like some strange noises. And I hung up very quickly because I thought, oh my God, it's, you know, mind control noises trying to do something to me. My mail was opened, and this wasn't something I was imagining. It was only from two people, a cattle mutilation researcher and an abduction researcher, Carla Turner, actually.
Opened in your mailbox?
No, I had a P.O. box. That's the other weird
That's
thing.
Weird.
Yeah, and it was only from those two people. Either the stuff was lost, or it was mangled, or it was opened. And the fact that you can open people's mail without them knowing made me think, well, somebody wants me to know that they're watching me. And that went on for about a year until I, strangely enough, made a conscious decision not to be paranoid anymore, and it all stopped. So I don't know if it's a coincidence that it stopped, or I just made the decision to stop being paranoid.
Well, and as you know, we don't believe in coincidences here, Greg. So.
Yes, exactly. So I don't know what happened during that period, but that was probably the strangest thing that happened to me during all this stuff, to me personally.
The government has admitted, basically, that it spent $22 million to investigate UFOs over about a 10-year period. And what do you think of that?
I think it's a minuscule amount as far as government projects go. I think they're only admitting to a little bit of what they did and what they're interested in because they know these things are flying around. They know these things are interested in military bases and things like that, and they would like to know what they are, and I don't think they know yet.
You don't think they have the crashed saucer from Roswell and they've done some reverse engineering on something like that?
I don't know. I think it's a possibility, but unless I can be shown something unequivocally and say, look, this is what it, or somebody that is completely trustworthy, or a group of people actually, it says, look, we looked at it, this is what it is, this is what appears to be, and based on our past record of what we've told you and the research we've done, we think that you will believe us when we say that this is, you know, actually what it is. And that hasn't happened yet, so I don't make a decision. I kind of leave myself open to anything that comes up. I don't disbelieve it, and I don't believe it, but I'm interested.
What's one of your favorite UFO cases?
Oh, geez. The Pascagoula case is probably my favorite, just because...
Tell everybody what that is. Mine is the Lonnie Zamora police officer case in Socorro, New Mexico.
Oh, I love that case.
I'll tell that in a second, but go ahead.
The Pascagoula, I think that happened in, I think it was 76. Seven, was it?
Couple guys were out there, right?
Yeah, they were out fishing in the at night, They heard a buzzing sound, and they looked around, and there was this thing that shaped like an egg with a blue glow around it, I think. These things came out of it, grabbed them. They looked like some kind of strange robots, took them in. They gave them the electric eye went over them or something, some kind of camera, dumped them back outside. And the weird part about this case, that's not the weird part. The weird and strange part is that, one, there was a secret recording made by the sheriff. When they went in, they didn't know who to talk to in the middle of the night, so they went to the sheriff's office. The sheriff said, oh, these guys are drunk, they're crazy, I don't know what's going on here. He put them in a room alone, but didn't let them know there was a recorder going. And the recorder just picked up their conversation, talking about how freaked out they were, what the hell are they going to do, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, do you believe in God, how does this relate? Just the normal things you would think when somebody would have that weird kind of an experience. And the thing about one of the witnesses, Charles Hickson, most people don't know this. Two or three times later, he had more sightings, one with his entire family. They saw this large thing hovering over the highway, scared them all to death. But it continued. Two or three or four more times throughout his life, he had either mental or actual physical, or at least he saw something, saw other objects in the air. So that's a very fascinating case to me.
And the Lonnie Zamora case, of course, that I mentioned was in 1964, Socorro, New Mexico. A police officer, Lonnie Zamora, who just recently died, was chasing a teenager into the desert in a speeding car when he saw a strange object in the desert. He called it a white object, thought it was a car that was flipped over. And so he got into the area to get closer and realized it was not a car, but it was some kind of craft, and he saw a couple occupants who he described as small human-looking who got into the craft and took off. And it was one of the most incredible sightings I think I've ever heard. And the fact that it comes from a police officer who is not going to lie about that, it's an amazing story, Greg.
Yeah, and there were other witnesses to that, too. Other people saw that object. In fact, a family was driving down the highway and saw Lonnie Zamora drive by and saw that object fly over the highway.
And you know, in 1964, we landed on the moon in 69. Uh-huh. So I thought maybe what he was looking at were lunar module tests in the desert where they would land and take off. But I don't think that was it. I think it was some kind of craft. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so, too. I don't think there's enough information to say that it was definitely some sort of, test craft from White Sands, which is nearby where they were testing that kind of stuff. But I don't think they were testing that kind of equipment at that time. I may be wrong, and we may find out something later. But I think it's still unsolved. I actually went there once. I went to the actual site. They had little rocks where supposedly the landing pad.
Really? Is it weird? Do you feel strange energy out there?
No, not really. it's just a plain sight out in the middle of the desert. I felt a sense of history and being excited because this, a very, very important UFO, foundational UFO sighting case.
I remember flying over Pearl Harbor once, and it was one of the weirdest experiences because in a plane, it looks so small.
Yeah.
And you're going, that's how we got involved in World War II, right around this area. And you try to picture Japanese planes bombing our ships and all the horror that went on during that time period. And it's just, it's eerie. It's very surreal, Greg. And I just sometimes wonder if you get that at different UFO sites and stuff.
I'll tell you an eerie thing, experience I had. Very strange. I mean, it's not paranormal.
Hold on. We're going to hit a break, and we'll get into that when we come back. Greg Bishop, our special guest. Next hour, we'll take phone calls where you can share your paranormal stories with us or ask Greg a question about what we're talking about. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I will definitely not pronounce it. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie here along with Greg Bishop, author, researcher, and, of course, does his own paranormal podcast, which you can see at coasttocoastam.com. It's all linked up for you. Greg, you were about to tell us a story, and the break hit us. Want to get into that?
Yeah, you're talking about eerie feelings and you flying over Pearl Harbor. Last year I went to Alamogordo, and my host took us out to an old church built in 1910 or something like that. We went out in the graveyard and looked at people's graves. Right near this church, near Alamogordo, north of Alamogordo, is a huge petroglyph site. Thousands of these petroglyphs on these rocks. But the weird thing is, about 12 miles away is the Trinity site, where the first atomic bomb was set off in July, I believe, of 1945.
They built mock houses. They put dummies in there to see what would happen as if they were humans. They had it all there.
Yeah, the weird thing was, standing there, I realized that in July of 1945, I could have stood there at 5:30 in the morning, whatever it was, standing next to these petroglyphs, and they would have been lit up by the first atomic explosion in history. That was a weird feeling.
Was there any radiation still out there?
There's traces, I guess, right near the site, but once you get, you know, within a few hundred feet of the site, I think, or maybe a little further, there isn't really any. And they allow people to go there twice a year. They take groups out there, and they allow you to walk around the site.
There was a rumor that actors like John Wayne and so many others who had done some desert filming in that region all died of cancer. It was really strange.
Actually, that was in Monument Valley, which was downwind from the Nevada test site.
Yeah.
And all the radiation. Yeah, the director Dick Powell, he died of cancer. Well, I mean, these people smoke, too, but there's a huge incidence of cancer, like way, way, way over the average for people that, you know, at that time in that period. And they all worked in Monument Valley at the time, downwind from the atomic testing.
You still write a lot of essays, don't you?
I write essays for books, for magazines. I just signed on with a couple of different websites. I'll be writing more. There's a book coming out pretty soon that I co-authored with my friend Adam Gorightly, and then I've got another book project in the works that'll probably be out early next year.
What fascinates you about book writing?
Because you're forced to concentrate on one subject and find out as much as you can about that subject. And the only, you know, your only ticket for that, the only payment for that really is that you have to actually sit down and write the book afterwards or during while you're doing the research. The research is the fun part. The writing is just the writing is not the fun part.
It's the end part, but not the fun part.
Yeah, and if you're curious, it's the best excuse in the world. And I was trying to help my wife with something yesterday. She's trying to get a doctorate right now, and she was asking me for a little bit of perspective.
What's your major in?
She is majoring right now in mythological studies.
Wow.
So it's fascinating to me to see her doing working on her papers and her coursework and all that. But she asked me a question, and I realized that I could not organize my thoughts properly unless I started writing it down. I sat down and wrote probably a couple paragraphs. I said, okay, now I know what I wanted to say. So it was weird to me that I had to work it out on, you know, on the computer, not on paper, but I had to type it out with my fingers to get the idea straight in my mind. So I guess just doing it, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of times, that's how my mind works now. So it helps me work out problems, and I make discoveries that way just by thinking deeply about something by having to write about it.
How do you think the media, Greg, handled UFO cases and sightings years ago? A little more credibility than we have today, or did they laugh at it?
I think they mostly laughed at it because news was seen as a very serious pursuit and UFOs was not seen as a very serious pursuit, so it was made fun of. Also, of course, the Robertson panel in the 50s suggested that the authorities actually downplay, poo-poo, and make fun of the UFO subject because it could be used for nefarious purposes or panic or whatever. And people generally listened to and trusted the government at that time, so I think a lot flowed from that. But that's starting to change, and I think, you know, I think that's great. I think that's a great result.
Well, we had people, too, like George Adamski, who claimed that he went to Venus, and I think a lot of people ridiculed him and those stories in those days, too.
Yeah, funny, because that next book I was talking about is about the UFO contactees of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. Big fat coffee table book on that.
Are you going to include the Barney and Betty Hill case?
Well, that's not really a contactee case, but we might have mentioned it. It's funny, we did include...
Well, it is a contactee. I mean, they were abducted.
Yeah, but to me, the definition of contactee is somebody that says that people from outer space had come down and told them a certain message, and they had visited them over and over again.
And
like
left.
Like Adamski or George Hunt Williamson or, you know, even Rael, the guy that started the Raelian cult.
Okay. Have you looked at the Barney and Betty Hill case?
Yes. Actually, I wrote an essay about it that got everybody really mad because I...
Why? What did you conclude?
I made no conclusion. I just suggested that I pointed out an essay by a writer called Martin Kottmeyer who said that there was an episode of Outer Limits that had aired a few months or a month before Barney and Betty went in to do their first hypnosis session, and the aliens in that looked suspiciously like the aliens that Barney and Betty had talked about. Now, that doesn't mean to me that they imagined everything and it's based on an old TV show, an old Outer Limits, but what it did suggest to me is that whatever happened to them may have been polluted by having those images, if they even saw those images, they never claimed that they did, in that episode. I think it was called The Bolero Shield with Martin Landau.
Interesting. Yeah. You'll get a kick out of this. Back in 1971, I'm a 21-year-old radio reporter in Detroit, and I interviewed their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I have ripped every box that I have had over the years to see if I could find those tapes, but I can't find them. But but I asked him specifically if they were lying, and he said, I don't know what happened to them. So he qualified this. He said, I don't know what happened to them, but whatever happened to them, they believe it to be true.
Yes.
He said, George, in hypnosis, I hypnotized both of them separately. They said similar stories. They added to each one's story. You know, one stopped, the other picked up. He said, but I don't know what happened. He said, but whatever happened, they believe it to be true, so they're not lying. It was a great interview.
Yeah, I would agree with him. I think that's a good assessment of the case.
And you know, Look magazine ran the story, and it became one of the big UFO abductee cases ever. And,
yeah, did you know that we linked an appearance of Barney Hill on To Tell the Truth, actually talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, that was amazing to see that, and nobody made fun of him.
Nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And that was an amazing. You would have thought that one of the panelists would have heard who he was. Because obviously the producers found them from some kind of publicity.
Somewhere. Yeah, somehow. Maybe it came from Benjamin Simon's book or something. I mean, it was a sensation at the time, at least a minor one.
Yeah. And John Fuller wrote a book on that, The Interrupted Journey.
Yes, exactly.
It's amazing. So you continue to pound away at UFOs primarily, and who would you say are the great UFO investigators of this era?
This era.
Those that are still with us, like Stanton Friedman, for example. I'd put Stan
in there because whether I agree with him or not, he has been tireless about it. He is thoughtful about it, and he's basically promoted the idea that as something serious to for serious-minded people to discuss, look at, be involved with. But he's, you know, performed a great service.
Travis Walton.
Yeah, Travis. Just by sharing what happened to him, has made a lot of people aware of what was going on and got them interested in the subject. Probably my favorite, and he's still alive, thank goodness, is Jacques Vallée.
Yes.
Many of his ideas. I mean, I don't even realize. I'll think of something. I say, "Well, that's great."
Well, his are very.
I read it in one of his books.
He's very revolutionary. He believes, if we can paraphrase him a little bit, that these are more dimensional. Does he not?
That's one of his ideas. See, the thing that fascinates me about his work is that he takes things where the evidence leads, and he doesn't force evidence into some kind of framework. And he has very many different ideas about it. It's not just one idea. One of them might be interdimensional. I'm fascinated, and I have been since I was a kid, with the idea that the UFO witnesses have been seeing these things for thousands of years, and it just conforms to whatever we believe to be unknown at the time, and we assign those things to it, like, you know, fairies and elves or demons or angels or whatever they are. And that nobody had really thought of, you know, nobody had really made that connection up to then in the 1960s when he first wrote about it.
Kevin Randall, great researcher.
Yes, I have a lot of respect for Kevin, especially because when new information shows up, he is willing to change his mind and say, look, I've changed my mind.
That's right.
I was wrong.
That's right.
That's really rare.
Nick Pope, another good one.
Yeah, I like Nick a lot, too.
And we're getting some younger people up, too, right, like John Greenwald?
Yeah, Greenwald I have a lot of respect for. He's very dogged and very intelligent about the way he goes about finding this information. You know what I would say is not a researcher, but one of my favorite writers on the UFO subject still is Whitley Strieber.
Oh, yeah, Whitley's great.
And a lot of people have problems like, did he make that up? You know, how far does he take this? How much is his imagination? I really don't care, because to me, reading Strieber and from Communion on, his visitors books, to me, it's like having an artist doing deep research on UFOs and abductions, not somebody who's science oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Having an artist do it, and that I think is valuable. There's not nearly enough of that.
Well, something happened to Whitley. Something happened to him, and you know
I'm certain something happened to him. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
And over too, not just once. And this has happened to other people. It's just that the way Whitley describes it, he's an author. He's an artist and an author. And the way his mind works around the subject brings up issues and ideas and a depth to it that I don't see in a lot of other people.
Greg, have you come across a story about what is called the Black Knight Satellite?
Yes, we published a story about it in Excluded Middle in the 90s sometime.
That is an incredible story where people believe there's a satellite going around the globe that came from the star system Epsilon Butes.
And oh, really? They actually have a location?
Yeah, they have a location for it.
Yeah.
And it's a bizarre, bizarre story in that it's monitoring us on this planet. And it's just going around. I mean, if that's the case, you would think we could find it, don't you?
Yeah, well, if it didn't want to be found, if the technology is advanced enough, then that's kind of a problem I have. If the technology is advanced enough, I don't think we'd be able to see it. It would be completely out of our awareness. If it could get all the way here, why would it make itself obvious? But it's still a fascinating idea. And the fact is that... The first story we ran about it back in the 90s sometime was that it had been detected by radar before we had put anything up into space.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
exactly
the story I remember about it, and that's what fascinated me about it in the first place.
Who are some of your favorite coast-to-coast guests? Are they much some of the same people we just mentioned?
Yeah, some of those same people. And let's see, when Nick's on, I always listen, because I like Nick, and he always has something interesting to say. He does have very esoteric ideas about a lot of this, and usually he doesn't talk about it. He'll get into it occasionally on Coast, and he certainly gets into it on my show because that's what I dig at. I want to dig at the stuff the person normally doesn't talk about.
He is great at conferences and events. He's got a great following.
Uh-huh. Chris O'Brien I like a lot. He's been a friend of mine for a long time. Very, very important researcher into the cattle mutilation issue. And very agnostic about it. People may think, you know, he thinks it's aliens or whatever. He has no idea what it is. And that's one reason I respect him for it. He's also started a project called the San Luis Valley Project, setting up detectors, cameras, et cetera, in the San Luis Valley in Colorado where
lots of sightings,
sightings happen. And he's trying to catch these things on camera.
Well, you know, we've got some good, pretty interesting video these days of pilots and, you know, chasing UFOs and things.
Right.
And they're baffled by it. What could these things be? They're not natural. They're not man-made. What are they?
I'm going to remain agnostic and say I have no idea what they are. But also, they're fascinating, and they should be looked at, and they should be discussed in the way that they're being discussed now. That's, you know, one of the good upshots of the... all this publicity from the New York Times and to the stars and all that, no matter what you think about their motivations or what they might be doing, what's happened, the upshot of all this, and I think this is part of what they want to do, is that serious people are taking it seriously. I think that's a great thing. That's a great thing to happen. So that, you know, smarter people, more groups of smarter people with better information, with better equipment, better resources available to them, can take a look at this and start, you know, researching in a way that hasn't been before, because, you know, people have been either secretive about it or embarrassed to, you know, if they have a science degree or something, they're embarrassed to take it seriously. That those barriers are coming down, and I think that's great.
Do you think the public could handle the fact that we're being visited by extraterrestrials from, let's say, other planetary systems?
Yeah, I think they could completely handle it, because I think there's a lot of people that believe that already.
I think they're ready for it.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's a problem for most people. It's just, you know, the full reality of it may make a bunch of people go crazy for a while, but it's not going to bring society down, especially, you know, if it continues the way it is. It's furtive in the background, and it's not really a part of anybody's daily life, really. If that happens, if somebody says, look, there really are people coming here from other planets, like, does that mean you don't have to go to your job anymore? No. Does that mean that your family life is going to be different? No, not really. Do you have to make house payments? Yeah, you still got to do that. So I don't, you know, after an initial shock, I don't think it'd be that big of a problem.
You collect UFO theme songs. What are your favorites?
I think I'm closing in on about 90 UFO themed songs.
Jeez, does that include UFO Phil singing his thing?
No, I don't have that in there.
Toss it in there. Go ahead and use it.
Okay, let's see. There's one called Take Me to Your Ladder, I'll See Your Leader Later, which is about giant women.
And these are real songs, right?
That's a real song. There's one called Space Mice by Walter Brennan about mice coming from space and hanging out.
Old actor, Walter Brennan?
Yes, Walter Brennan recorded a song called Space Mice.
From the real McCoys.
Yes, that Walter Brennan.
I love it. We'll be back, Greg, and take some phone calls with you next.